Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
And you bet, here I am, and have we got a great guest. I've had the opportunity to speak to this gal before, and she is dynamite. But I got to introduce her. So was she nasty? Oh, yes, she was. Was she hateful? You bet. And she was really good at it. She was and still is, because we see her still on the tube, Nellie Olson on the classic Little House on the Prairie TV series. Now, some called her a little hellcat. And let's face it, I'm sure there were times that they wanted to give her a big smack. But in real life, Alison Arngrim reveals herself in her book called Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. But her talent, well, it has carried her into so much more as a really good actress, a stand-up comedian, and well, you're just going to have to hear the whole story. How did she survive Nellie Olson? Well, we're going to have to ask her. Hi, Alison. How are you?
Hi. I am very good. How are you?
Hanging in there. I'll tell you, I still love watching Little House on the Prairie, and I love your character. You were so good. I mean, people still, you say, sometimes shy away from you. That means you were really good in your part.
I really made an impression. You know, when I was talking about this the other day with Dean Butler, our lovely old man, that, you know, Little House was such an emotional show that I think people just zoomed into it on an emotional level and suspended all disbelief, just a sort of visceral reaction. So there I was being horrible. Maybe it was another show. People would have said, oh, she's a good actress. But it was Little House, so they just said, I hate her. That was that.
It's amazing. But, you know, really being that... How did you come about? How did you develop the character? Was it you that wanted to be nasty, or was that part of the script?
Oh, no. If you read the books, as Laura Ingalls explained, Nellie was pretty bad. She's kind of based on three people, really.
Oh.
Laura Ingalls Wilder was, when she was living in Walnut Grove, Minnesota, where the third book, Banks of Plum Creek, takes place, which they based the show on. Nellie Owens was an actual girl she went to school with, the Owens family, who ran the store. And Nellie was very spoiled. She was quite awful. But when she wrote the book, she changed the name because she thought Nellie might come after her.
Yeah.
And then she, in the book, you know, the family, the Ingalls, moved to South Dakota. Well, people were writing in and asking for more Nellie because it was such a great character because she was so awful. And so she really had to make stuff up. So she decided that Genevieve Masters and Stella Gilbert, who were other girls who were dreadful, she combined them into one person, so Nellie Olson suddenly appears in the books in South Dakota. So Nellie Olson was already a character in the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who was fairly well-hated. But she was only a certain level of rotten. So I get the part, and I go, wow, this girl's a villain. This girl's a, I mean, the audition. I go to the audition. I hadn't read the books.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know there was Nellie. I get there, and I read the pages of the audition. I turned to my father and said, this girl is awful. She's a bitch. And my father said, what are you talking about? And I read it for him, and he starts laughing. He says, you read it just like that. Don't change anything. Don't change it. You just do it. Don't even rehearse it. And I went and I read it for Michael Landon, the other producers, and they couldn't stop laughing. They hired me on the spot.
Really?
So I went, okay, she's bad. And I kind of escalated it. I made, I guess, a little worse. And then I'd get the scripts, the next script, and, well, she got worse and worse. And by the, you know, the third season, there I am pretending to be paralyzed and being pushed down a hill in a wheelchair, which definitely was not in the book. So she was terrible in the books, and I made her worse.
That is, well, you were the triple threat is what you were. That's it. That's amazing.
Thank you.
I can't believe 50 years ago. It's an anniversary now, right? The 2024?
This is so, so crazy. Here we are. It is 2024. Show aired in 1974. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Little House on the Prairie. We can't believe it. None of us can believe it. We're like, how did this even happen? Where did 50 years go?
Yeah.
This is totally insane.
How old were you when you started, Nellie?
I was 12. So, yes, I'm 62 now.
Hey, you look dynamite, babe.
Well, thank you. I try. I do my best. But it's absolutely amazing. 50 years, and we never believed when we were making the show that people would still be watching us 50 years later.
If they are.
Because, you know, when we were filming, there was no cable TV, let alone DVDs or VHS or any of this stuff.
Yeah.
So it was just a shock to all of us that this show lasted this long and that all of these people are still into it. We just never imagined it. So here we all are, and having these events all over the country. Dean Butler's got a book coming out. We're doing autograph shows and historical prairie events in every state in the U.S. I'm heading out to France. I started booking my stand-up show, as they often do, but because it's the 50th, everyone's gone wild and they're all sold out. It's just amazing.
Now, let me ask you, did you do your stand-up one-woman show in
Correct.
French? How the heck did you do that?
I've been doing my show. I've been doing stand-up off and on since I was a teenager, and I started doing this one-woman show, Confessions of Prairie Bitch, in about 2002. And I went to France around that time and found out that the show was a hit in France, that they just can't get enough Nellie Olson, that it's just a huge hit. Or as I like to say, they don't think Nellie Olson's mean. They think she's French.
and I love it.
I thought, well, I got to get in on this. This is fantastic. So I met this guy in France, Patrick Lebatier, and he said, we could do an adaptation of your one-woman show. We have to change things. Well, you're saying things that don't even make sense in French. It doesn't work. So he writes an entire show. So I wind up doing a show in French, and he's in it too because he would come out and explain things. And then I come out and I do tell a story, and then we run a video clip, and then he tells the story. It just goes a mass panic, huge hit. So then a couple of years later, he writes another show, Le Mal au Trésor de Nellie Olson, which is Nellie Olson's Drunken Treasures. We do this show for a while. We now have a brand new show we just started doing last year, Nellie Olson en Flamme, Les Années 80, which is Nellie Olson lights up the 80s. It's inspired to the 1980s.
Wow.
It's so funny. There's stuff about Little House, and then there's stuff about just the 80s and crazy 80s trivia and game shows. It's really, really fun.
You're still you're on the road like I've never seen anybody on the road.
Oh, I just got back. I keep looking, go, what day is it? Oh, yeah, I got back Tuesday night.
All right, and then you're the 31st, you're back out again.
Exactly, I'm off to Kansas. I'm going to say the Independence, Kansas, which is where, you know, because the first book was Little House in the Big Woods, and it's Little House in the Prairie, and in that book, that's like the pilot episode of the show where Laura and her family go to Independence, Kansas and build a house. That house, the Independence, Kansas, is a museum and a site in the house. So we're going to get to go see the Little House in the Prairie in Independence, Kansas. But a bunch of us from the show are going, and we'll have meet and greets with fans and sign autographs and all that fun stuff. And this is what we like to do. So I'll be doing that in Kansas. Where is my schedule? Let me just pull up my schedule. My friend said, I looked at your schedule, and I had to take a nap after. So I'm doing this. I get a little time off for this Memorial Day weekend. Then it's Kansas. Then I get back, and then me and a bunch of the cast, we're going to Monte Carlo. We're going to Monaco for the Monte Carlo Television Festival, and that's going to be huge. Then let's take a little break. Oh, and then I'm going to Provincetown, Massachusetts in July. I'm doing my show there. And I get home just in time to turn around and go to Walnut Grove, Minnesota, the real Walnut Grove. And we're a big fan event with the cast. Turn right around, go to Keystone, South Dakota, where you can see Mount Rushmore and the lovely Crazy Horse Monument. Uh-huh. And we're doing a big Little House thing there. Then I'm doing my show in San Francisco, August 1st.
Uh-huh.
Then I get a break in August. Yeah, it's my husband's birthday. We have to plan the party. But then I go to Connecticut. This is huge. Hartford, Connecticut. Going to be a very big Little House event, and we're following it up with an event in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Then the next weekend, we're going to Johnny Cash's farm just outside Nashville. And 2 weeks later, I'm going to Salt Lake City for the huge FanX autograph show convention. And then I leave for France for a month.
Holy smokes. What vitamins do you take to keep going like that?
All of them.
You name it, you take it, right?
I find vitamin B very helpful, especially for the nerves and keeping your energy up. And it's very useful. I love taking coenzyme Q10.
Oh, yeah.
It's supposed to be good for your teeth, for the gums, and for your skin, but it's very good for cardiac health. And I find it seems to help with, you know, nerves, which with going on stage all the time is definitely important. So.
Oh, absolutely. But no, I mean, I looked at your schedule and you gave me some more in there that I didn't even see. And I'm going, holy smokes.
It's
how does she keep
crazy.
Going?
Yep.
But, you know, and being 62, you're young. I'm almost 78, so don't
Oh, wow.
Let's not even go there. But you know, you love what you do. Isn't that what keeps you going?
Well, it is. It is. I mean, that's the thing, is that I enjoy this. I mean, I've always worked. I've always performed. I've always done something. And I enjoy doing stand-up. I enjoy acting. I enjoy meeting people. And I couldn't really just stay home and do nothing. That would be crazy. And besides, my doctor, my husband and I, our doctor always says, don't retire if you can possibly not retire, really. because he says, it's just not good for you.
Aww.
He says, you know, people, they retire, they don't do anything, and, you know, they just wind up just sitting around doing nothing. And it's like the body, the brain sends a signal to the body that we're done.
Well, they say
and
that
just,
when people
not good for you.
Retire and, you know, completely from everything, don't have hobbies, nothing.
No.
16 months, they're gone. They die.
Yeah. It just goes, my doctor said, a few people retire. He said, but you travel, or you take a part-time job,
yeah.
or you volunteer full-time, you write a book, you do something. He says, the people just sit down, well, I don't have to do anything. Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible for your health. So I keep going, and I really like doing it. I love performing, and it's, when I was a little girl, I used to watch Carol Burnett's show.
Oh,
you know,
God,
and she'd come out, she'd answer questions from the audience. And I said, now there's a job. There's a job I'd like to have. You just come out and answer questions to the audience.
Uh-huh.
And I was told, well, that's not technically a job. It is my job now. Part of my stand-up show is I have a question and answer segment. I'm basically doing the Carol Burnett gig.
Oh, I love it. What do they ask you?
Oh, my God, they ask everything. They ask normal things. I mean, they ask about, like, well, oh, good Lord, what was it like to be on the show and to work with Michael Landon and to have everyone hate you? And what is this like? And I joke about that, you know, they ask the same things all over again. You know, were you really a bitch? Was that really your hair? What was Michael Landon really like? How much did you get paid? But sometimes they ask completely crazy off-the-wall things, or they'll even ask things that are, you know, somewhat
personal.
R-rated.
Yeah.
and I just find it hilarious, and I answer everything.
Talking about the wig, where did that wig come from that you wore?
Oh, my God. So, when I started the show, they did try curling my hair, because Nellie has those fabulous ringlets, and my hair is straight as a pin. It just does not curl. So they get me in curlers. I had to sleep in curlers as a child and come into work 4 o'clock in the morning, get my hair, nightmare. So they're doing all this, and it won't stay. I mean, they're spraying, and the Pantene, and the Aquanets, and the thing, and the curling iron. And the poor hairdresser's having to go, oh, I've got to fix her hair, Okay, let me get the curling iron. And fix my hair all day long. And I'm miserable, because I'm sleeping in curlers, and it's just a nightmare. And they went to the producer and said, we have to get a wig. Her hair doesn't stay curled. This is a very elaborate hairdo. The grown-up actresses have wigs for these kind of hairdos. What are we thinking? Is the child going to do this? So they said, done. So they brought in this guy, Ziggy Geike, wig maker to the stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he only died quite recently. I mean, I thought he was 100 then. He lived to be very, very old, did wigs for all the big movies. This guy comes in to make my wig, and it was he and Larry Germain, who's one of the hairdressers on Little House. And he'd worked with Betty Davis. I mean, they all worked with her. We had Marilyn Monroe's makeup man on Little House, for God's
sake. Wow.
So these guys sit down and design this whole wig from scratch. They put a plastic thing on my head and drew pictures on it of where they wanted the girls. And they got all this beautiful hair and matched it exactly to the color of my hair. Unbelievable. And they build this thing. I was told it was one of the most expensive wigs made for a television show at that time.
No kidding.
It cost a fortune. So they said, well, we're keeping this. And they put this on my head. And, of course, as you see from then on, my curls stayed perfect. Even if I went down a hill in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
my hair stayed perfect 24/7. So they said, that's it, you're wearing the wig. And they readjusted it and styled it slightly differently when I got to be like 16, 17. And when I left the show, they kept it. I said, not yours, dear. They put it on that little girl, Allison Balson, who played Nancy. They put it on her head.
Oh, my God.
Nancy, when the Uncle stopped it, had my hair.
Well, it was expensive. They were going to throw it away.
Right, we're not giving it up. We're going to reuse it.
Yeah.
We're recycling this thing. So they put it on her head, which looked great. And then, of course, I come back for a guest spot for a whole thing where we meet up. And, well, they said, well, what are we going to do? Where's her wig? Her wig's on the other kid's head. And they go, well, she's married with kids. She's been away for a while. Clearly, she'd have a different hairdo.
Yeah.
So they got a different wig and created this very crazy kind of Gibson girl, foofy-doo. And it was very fancy, but honestly, I thought it looked like a Jiffy Pop popcorn thing where my head had blown up. And everyone was like, what is on your head? That is not your hairdo. I go, well, it would have been fashionable at the time.
Yeah,
it was very modern.
Fit the
but
time.
But good heavens, I look very silly.
Now, you come from a very talented family. I mean,
I do.
It wasn't like you just decided you were going to be an actress. Your whole family was involved.
My parents met in the theater. I was supposed to be a theater child. I did. I started doing theater when I was like 13. But my parents met in the theater in Canada, and my mother went on to become Casper the Friendly Ghost.
No.
Gumby, Sweet Polly Purebred, Underdog's Girlfriend, which I really like, and Davy and Goliath.
Oh.
So my mother was the cartoon queen, and in the 60s, when I was a kid, watching cartoons.
No kidding. That's amazing.
I get up on Saturday morning with my cereal, I turn on the cartoons, and like half of them are my mother.
That's so funny. I love it.
Now, you said you're a little older than me, so you may remember this. Do you remember the first family album? It was a comedy album about the Kennedys.
Yeah, I do.
It was a big hit at the time. It was like Guinness Book of World Records. It had that picture on the cover where they're supposed to be in front of the White House. They shot it in Central Park in New York and photoshopped it. Vaughn Meader was a stand-up comic who did a Kennedy impression. So it was JFK and Jackie and the kids. And it was, by today's standards, it was really soft. It was very nice.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, it was shocking to do a comedy album about a seated president, about JFK and the family and everything. And it was a huge deal. My mother was the voice of Caroline and John John.
No way. Boy,
that's the biggest comedy album in the history of Earth.
That's amazing. That's an amazing talent.
That's where she got it. She'd been doing radio, and she got that Caroline and John John, and that was it. Then she could be any. The cartoon people came to her and said, who would you like to be? You know, do anything you want.
But that's a talent to have, you know, to mimic voices like that. That's incredible.
You know, that was her thing. I mean, when she started radio, my parents had a hilarious story. They'd come from the theater in Vancouver, and they'd moved to Toronto and gotten jobs in radio. And they were so excited because they had a friend who knew somebody, and it was hard to break in. They knew somebody, got a job right away. So when they got there, my father had done some radio, and Stuart Baker was the other guy who worked theater with him. He'd done some radio. My mother hadn't yet. So they get there, and they're bragging about their credits, going, well, I've done this. They're trying to really get their foot in the door. And the producer asked my mother, well, what do you do? And she said, I do children's voices.
Uh-huh.
Now, my dad almost started kicking her under the table because she'd never had a job doing children's voices.
Oh.
She made that up. She said, well, what would I do if I had a job? I guess I'd be doing the job. So they said, okay. And they didn't ask her any more questions. And they interviewed her, and they interviewed them all, and they sent them home. And my father and Stuart said, why did you do that? You don't have any credits. We at least have one or two credits.
Mm-hmm.
You just, out of nowhere, said children's voices. What could you be thinking? You're going to get us in trouble. The script comes. They're all hired. They're like, oh, my God, we all got a job immediately. It was like they would do these soap operas on the radio back then. And they would go on for months, and all these characters, and have all these, but it was all radio. You never see anybody.
Yeah.
It's just these, and it was the same thing as soap operas. People would get divorced, and so-and-so's having an affair, and everybody, so-and-so is in the hospital. It was, and some of the soap operas that are on now started in radio. It was that crazy.
My God.
They're on this radio soap opera, and they're all excited, and they're looking at it, and they said, well, how many pages? And my dad says, I'm on 3 pages. Stuart said, oh, I'm on 4 pages. And they turned to my mother, and they said, what pages are you on? And she said, all of them. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, the soap opera plot is about a little girl in one of the families. She's very disturbed. They have to take her to a psychiatrist. And the whole plot is all the characters are, what are we going to do about the kids? And what are they going to do? And the parents arguing. And I'm playing the kid. And so they didn't know what to. They said, what are you going to do? You've never even done this before. She said, I'll figure it out. And, of course, she was a smash, and she wound up being in almost every radio production in Toronto. She would have to, like, leave one and take a bus across town, catch the other one. And she was doing radio all day, and then they moved to New York, my father wound up on Broadway. My father was in Luther with Albert Finney, and he was in Broadway shows. And then my mother, of course, they had radio in New York, and then the cartoon boom started, and, that was it. Then she just couldn't stop working. It was crazy. Mm-hmm.
But your father also managed some real stars.
Right. So we come to California, and he decides, well, I'll go into management. I, did this theater thing. He did a couple TV shows. I've actually tracked down the couple of TV shows my father had a part in, and they're, like, hilarious.
Wow. Which ones?
There was a TV show that ran for a few seasons many, many years before I was born called Last of the Mohicans.
Oh, my God.
based on the movie. And I'm like, what? And there's my father in, like, British three-cornered hat, like a British soldier. I'm Lieutenant Lewis. I'm here about the fortress. Like, what is happening? So, yeah, he did a bunch of weird stuff. But they both were. He went into management, and he got a job working for Seymour Heller & Associates, the huge managers on Sunset Boulevard. And, well, Seymour Heller's clients included Debbie Reynolds and Liberace.
Holy smokes.
And did you see the Liberace movie they did about him?
Yeah.
Where and Dan Aykroyd played the manager, played Seymour, and he did a very good job. He was exactly like Seymour. So that's who my dad was working for.
Oh,
and
my
father was put in charge of Liberace. So Seymour said, I'll go with him to Vegas, and you take care of him in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, yeah, they were paying him a ton of money. They said, go rent a house in the Hollywood Hills near Liberace in case he needs anything, like you need to be at the house for an interview or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved to the Hollywood Hills, and we lived around the corner from Liberace.
Oh, my gosh.
And we'd go to Liberace shows when I was 8 years old. It was absolutely hilarious. Oh, my God. He was amazing. He really was good. Of course, I thought it was bonkers because my parents said, no, don't say anything, you know, because back in the 70s, they said, no one must know that Liberace is gay.
No, that's true.
I said, I'm sorry. I'm 8. I know he's gay. For heaven's sakes, look at this guy. So, but he was so wonderful, and I would go, we would go trick-or-treating, all the neighborhood kids, we have to go trick-or-treating, we got to go to Liberace's house. And he would be out at a party, but he had a butler in a suit with a silver tray bring candy to the door, and it was absolutely fantastic. So I've been to Liberace's house, I went to Liberace's shows, I saw the watch that's shaped like a piano, and the ring that's a candelabra, and the whole bit.
Women adored that man when he had his own television show, remember that?
Yes.
And I mean,
he was a huge. Do you know he had a TV show that ran 15 minutes? They did that in the early days of television.
Yeah, yeah.
A 15-minute television show, and it was a smash. Everybody watched it.
Yes, yes. And women, they did adore him. You could tell he was gay by today's standards. Who knows back then? You know, they didn't think about that.
They sort of knew. I mean, his shows were all sold out. You know, Liberace gave us one of our most famous phrases. People will say, "I laughed or all the way to the bank. I cried all the way to the bank."
Yeah,
that's Liberace. Some of the critics thought he was silly and said, what is it? This is ridiculous. The man plays the piano beautifully. He could be a classical musician. Why is he doing these ridiculous shows with all the light-up jackets and the flying over the stage and the reins? It's absurd. He's got to drive a car under the stage. This is silly. And they said his shows were terrible. Well, he never had a show that wasn't sold out.
Yeah.
They were all sold out all over the world. Yeah. They had to hold them over. He sold every ticket, and he made so much money. And he said on stage, he said, oh, when I read the review, I cried all the way to the bank. That was our Liberace. He said, oh, my God, do these people not know what I'm doing? All these women, they were crazy about him.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, hanging out at the concert. They knew. Yeah. They would say, oh, yes, he's, you know, you'd be safe with him. Oh.
Yeah,
got it. They just didn't care.
That's right. Well,
they were absolutely devoted to him. They didn't care. If you said to them, now, is Liberace gay? They'd have probably said, oh, that's terrible. Don't say that. But if you said, is Liberace going to marry you? They'd have said, well, don't be ridiculous. Of course not.
is great.
They knew, but they didn't say it, kind of thing.
You know what Liberace was? He was the Lady Gaga of his time.
Yes. Elton John. Why do you think Elton John got his whole act?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, you're right.
The glasses, the whole thing. He's like, he was doing Elton John before Elton John was a child. And he did it all. And it was brilliant. And he was like a rock star. They absolutely loved him. He talked to the audience. And he was very clever. He talked about how he wanted to bring classical music to people who normally just got show tunes or cabaret. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s, everything was very divided. You had the people who went to classical concerts and the opera, people who maybe went to musicals, and then people who just went to bars and clubs and got pop music. And then no, it didn't change. People didn't go to hear classical music. They just were never exposed to it. And he said, I'm going to play these concerts for people who normally listen to pop music or maybe show tunes, and I'm going to play classical music. I'm going to play Bach and Beethoven and everything for them.
But he made it like it was something special for them to have that, you know?
Exactly. And it was all fun. It was all just for them. And now just for you, I'm going to play. And it worked. And how many people who would not have been exposed to the classical masters took an interest in that because they went to a Liberace show?
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was obsessed with educating people. It was marvelous.
Was he pretty close to George Liberace?
Yeah, he really did do that. I wish my brother George was here. So close to his mother. That family was adored his mother. His mother adored him. And his mother, when she was older and she wasn't very well, was like in bed a lot, she had his boxes of his records under the bed. And she would sell you an album if you came to visit.
Oh, no way. Serious?
She did. She said, "How'd you have it? You know, I have something. I can get you one. I have some in the house." She would push his album. You must take one. She would push his merchandise and tell people to listen to his records and stuff.
Funny.
Even when she don't. Absolutely. She was crazy about it.
Well, George was great. I mean, he had a good band. I sang with him a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, they were so proud of him. I mean,
oh,
his mother
yeah.
thought he was going to be perhaps one of the great classical musicians of the age, and
yeah.
he went to a conservatory and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, well, I'm not quite making it here, and but there's a market here for me to go do this.
You bet.
Amazing. And he was very smart, and he jumped on that, and his family, well, they couldn't have been more proud.
Now, talking about being proud, you are such an active. How did you get into the activism? Because was it after your Little House on the Prairie husband, Steve Tracy, passed
yeah.
away? Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I always was a little bit. I mean, my parents laughed. They said, "You've always been like this." When I was about 6 years old, and you'll remember in the 60s when the Surgeon General first said smoking is hazardous to your health?
Yeah.
I was allowed to come downstairs before I went to bed to my parents' cocktail parties where people were smoking and wear my American Cancer Society visor and
no
say,
way.
"The Surgeon General has determined that smoking is hazardous to your health."
How cute. I love it.
And they'd say, "Well, she's right, you know. We're quitting ourselves. You should be quitting. We should all be cutting back." And they said, "She's not wrong." And so they let me do my social message. And they said, "There, that's her social service message. You've all been told. And you know she's right. It is terrible for you. We all should be quitting." And
yeah.
a few of them quit. But they said, "Well, you know, absolutely. That's what she's doing. She's trying to save it. We're having her do the Surgeon General message." So I was always doing crazy things like that. But I always did charity, so when I was on the show, there were always charity events and fundraisers to go to, and I really enjoyed that part of it, of using TV fame to help people.
Yes.
Many of the actors and that I even knew at the time, they'd go to all these events, and they would be bored. Like, "I don't want to go to this stupid charity event." And I'm like, "No, this is great. We're on TV, and now we're helping people. This is brilliant." So I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
And I always liked doing that part of it. And so then when things started happening, when Steve Tracy, brilliant actor, played Percival, he went public with having AIDS when nobody was doing that. I mean,
yeah.
Rock Hudson had like just died. No one was going public and talking about this. Liz Taylor, Joan Rivers, a handful of people were doing something. It was not, there was no red ribbon. There
no.
were also no drugs as we know them today. It was all experimental treatments. And he went public. He went on TV and he went to the National Enquirer and said, "Yes, I'm someone who you know has been in your living room. I have AIDS." And it was a brave, brave, marvelous thing to do at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Drew a huge amount of attention to it. And so I started volunteering. I was helping him, but Steve was so lucky. His mother and his sister flew out from Florida. They took care of him. He had friends. He had,
oh,
you know,
man.
He had the resources to get a good doctor. Many people did not.
No,
and
right.
I saw so many people, their families abandoned them. So I volunteered at AIDS Project Los Angeles, and I was on the hotline and the Speakers Bureau and everything else they had to help all of these people living with HIV then and to educate people because people were frightened out of their wits. 1986,
yeah.
Nobody knew anything. So I still go all over the country. I mean, there's still people living with AIDS in small organizations that help them, and I'm still raising money for them and doing what I can.
Good for you. You also, you know, had, like, children's projects, too. How did you get involved
yeah.
with that?
Well, years ago, there was a AIDS project I worked at, a thing called Tuesday's Child, where we helped families with children with AIDS. And then some years ago, I was approached by a group called National Association to Protect Children, an anti-child abuse group. And I went, "Oh, yes, mm-hmm. I want this." Marvelous stuff. They were doing stuff legislatively, which was very new. People were saying, "Well, we're helping this, we're doing that, we're raising money for victims." They said, "We're going to go into the Washington, D.C. and the state houses and the state capitals and actually change laws to better protect victims." I said, "Oh, count me in for that."
Okay.
So I joined that. It's called protect.org, and we've done a lot of stuff. We've trained people to work with the police, the ICAC teams that fight child pornography and trafficking. I mean, you name it, we've done it. And I'm president of the board of directors. Of
Good
Protect
for you.
Today. And we've done so much to help fight the crime of child molestation, child pornography. We've changed laws in multiple states and at the federal level to more funding for police, all kinds of stuff. We've gotten, we had a whole technological arm, a whole tech center, the Tech Center for Child, the Weiss Center for Child Rescue Technology. Mm-hmm. We've actually had scientists develop technology so that the police can do a better job. Because, you know, a lot of these people on the Internet, they're very clever. They're encrypting things. They're trading images and children with, and they're managing to evade the police because of the tech they can use. And we have enabled police departments to break through that and go get them.
Yeah, great. That is so great. You know what? So many young child actors couldn't make it into adulthood. You know, there were suicides, there were overdoses, all that kind of thing. What? How could you do? I mean, you're still going strong. I mean, your schedule was just incredible.
Right. Well, it's a lot of work. You need to stay busy. So it's. I was always sort of had a real, you know, survivor mentality, I guess. You know, from peasant stock, Canadian. But it is difficult. When I first got off the show at 19, and you know, I'd gone through junior high and high school. I was still on the show. I got my braces on, my braces off my teeth. I'd moved out of my parents. I bought a condominium. I'm still on the show. Yeah. It was a little crazy to be on something that long.
Yeah.
So I'm in my early 20s, and I'm basically having a midlife crisis like I'm in my 50s because I've had an entire career. I've actually had more than one career. I started working when I was about 6.
Wow.
And when I was 10, I did a movie, and then when I was 11, I wasn't working that much. And my father actually said, well, you might not work again until after 18. Technically, Little House was my comeback. I'd already had a career.
Oh, for heaven's
sake.
Stopped,
and then restarted with Little House.
Wow. Michael
Lennon. So I had my second career. So I was now, like, looking for my third career at 20.
Well, you're doing darn good. Darn good. I got to ask you, though.
I was like, what am I going to do? I was doing stand-up, thank heaven. So I was able to tour, do some stuff stand-up. But it was difficult. I did the usual Love Boat and Fantasy Island. But trying to figure out, well, now who am I? I've been this person who's on Little House and is Nellie Olson for 8 million years. Now what?
Okay, let me ask you, though. Who are you now?
Right. Who are you now? And I was also a cute blonde, blue-eyed girl. And so in the 80s, everything was be a cheerleader or dead or a combination there. Naked, a cheerleader, or dead, or a combination of all three. And it was all the bimbo movies, and I wasn't cut out for that. So I'm like, what do? Am I the topless bimbo in this? No, that's not me. What the heck am I supposed to do? And it was so crazy. It was a very crazy time to begin with. And I thought, I'm not sure what to do with all this. So thank God I had the stand-up. And as I said, I also did theater. I had the theater background, thank heaven. And then when I was about 22 or 3, I got heavily into activism and working with AIDS Project Los Angeles. And I literally became an employee. I was a board member and staff, Tuesday's Child, with kids with AIDS. So I was working in that. And then the stand-up really tided me over. And then what happened is somewhere in the 90s, Little House, which never really quite went away, had a massive revival. Maybe it was the DVDs, all the channels, like I Love the 70s kind of stuff going on. I don't know. But there was this explosion in the 90s, and I was doing all those Where Are They Now shows, and I Love the 70s. And I started getting recognized more in the mid-90s than I did when I was on the show. And I said,
no
kidding.
What the
heck is going on?
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, this is great. So I kind of cashed in on that, and I started doing these personal appearances, and I started touring and speaking. I was doing all the speaking engagements because of my work in AIDS. So I thought, okay, fine. So I do speaking engagements. I can do this. And then I started discovering these marvelous places where Laura Ingalls really lived. I wound up visiting Walnut Grove. And I started doing the events at the official Little House sites. I said, well, this is quite a thing they've got going here. You should do this. Well, it kept going, and I wound up with a healthy, you know, touring stand-up career. And then the 2000s hit, and all of a sudden I had a new show. All True Stories, my one-woman show. All of a sudden, Little House has a mega revival. I write a book. That goes bonkers. Became a bestseller. And then, of course, during the pandemic, people turned to Little House.
Yeah.
They started watching it more than ever. Famous people were talking about Little House on the Prairie on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Snoop Dogg was retweeting things, talking about the episode with Todd Bridges. It was absolutely crazy. We said, what is happening? What is happening to us? And all of a sudden, Little House was bigger than ever. I had my book. I had my stand-up show. I started doing my show online.
Oh, wow.
Everything was closed. We couldn't go out. I did online comedy pay-per-view shows. I had an online store. I sold people bonnets.
I love it.
I started reading. I said, fine, I'm stuck at home. You're all stuck at home. I'm going to read the Little House on the Prairie books. I'm going to start at the first book, chapter 1, page 1, and I'm going to read them live, chapter a day, every single day, on Facebook. And I read for 2.5 years. I read over 600 times.
My gosh.
Live, every day, at 1 o'clock. 1:30, actually, usually. Sometimes I change. I have guest stars. Dean Butler, he came in and he read some. He said, hey, I want to read The Long Winter. It's the good one with Alanzo. I said, you're on. And we took turns. And people loved it. It was for free. The one on Facebook, that was totally for free. So I'm just going to read these books. I wanted to do it to keep myself sane. Yeah. And I wanted to reread the books and see how the characters develop, reread them as an adult. And everybody else did too, apparently. And thousands of people tuned in, and we had so much fun. And to this day, people are coming up to me saying, you have no idea how much easier you made it for me to get through that terrible time, because I knew at least once a day I could just watch Allison read a book.
I think that's fantastic. You know, on the show, Michael Landon, when I talked to Melissa Gilbert, mm-hmm. she said that he was very much a father figure on the set. Is that true?
Well, for her, I mean, good heavens, he was playing her father. He really was. And her family and his family, they'd go to Hawaii on vacation together. I mean, he was
no
her
kidding.
Dad. Oh, I didn't
know that.
He was incredible. But for me, he had an absolutely wicked sense of humor. He loved to laugh. He had this high-pitched giggle. You knew Michael was there because, you know, you'd arrive at work and you'd hear, this high, like, girl-like, and you go, Michael's here. How good. And he wanted to play practical jokes. Part of him never fully grew up. And so when he directed the kids, he could really talk to these children. That's why you see these brilliant performances from all these little children and then us teenagers, because he knew how to talk to us. He knew how to get through. He wasn't like, well, just do this. He wasn't barking orders at children. He would sit down and talk to Melissa and Melissa Sue and these little children, go, here's what's going on. This is why we're doing the scene. This is important. This is what's happening. And it was incredible. And he got this performance out of everyone. He was a brilliant director and a brilliant producer, and he was writing the shows. And he thought what Nellie did was hilarious. I always remind people, I mean, I was evil, but Michael's directing. He's the one standing next to the camera going, hit her again.
Yeah.
You know? It wasn't my idea. He wrote half this stuff. So he was coming up with all these terrible things I was doing because he thought it was funny as all get out. And he loved to joke around, and he had a totally childish sense of humor. And it just made working there so much easier. I mean, 7 years is a long time.
Well, and long times on the set, too.
And he's joking around every 5 minutes. It was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
So how did you go to school during that time? Because you were 12 years old when you started up to 19. Yeah?
Well, what they do in California, now they have rules. I have to tell you, many states do not follow the rules. And many productions shoot out of state, and they don't follow any of the rules. And it's terrible, and everybody's trying to pass more. We're trying to pass more laws because we've got to crack down on this stuff. But in California, thank heavens, and in New York, we have the rules where it's 4 hours work, 3 hours school, and 1 hour rest and recreation. You have to have a work permit every 6 months. Not only does your doctor have to sign off that you're healthy enough to be working, but your school, either the principal or the dean or your counselor, has to sign off that you're not failing any classes, that you're getting good grades, and you have to keep your grades up. And what they do is there's a teacher on the set, or the State of California welfare worker, licensed teacher, and you bring your assignments from school. Now, I sometimes went back to school because I wasn't in every episode.
Yeah.
So I'd, like, shoot for 2 weeks, go to school for 3 days, shoot for 3 days, go to school for 2 weeks, back and forth, back and forth. So I would get my assignments. I'm going to be out for a month, and they give me all my assignments. And then I would do my algebra and English and science homework.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher could help me. And she would also, at the end, each day, she'd say, what did you work on? I said, well, I did this many pages in the math book, and I did this. And she would check off all the boxes on the form that I had to hand in at school with my finished homework that I had done the work. And this all went to this. It's very strict. Now, Melissa Gilbert and Melissa Sue Anderson were in every single episode.
Yeah.
So they just sort of checked out of school somewhere in May. And, you know, they basically, like, we broke in, like, February. So, like, February to late May, June, you could go to school. And then off you went. They went and got their assignments for the rest of the year.
And
just marched off to the tutor. And Melissa Gilbert went to Buckley School in L.A. And Melissa Sue, she went to a Catholic school. And then she went to, actually, the French school in L.A. It was very good. But they brought their assignments, and they had the teachers. So the teachers on the set, they were licensed to give exams. So the two Melissas actually got their final exams on set.
Oh, wow.
Whereas I would go back to school, and they would just arrange the schedule. But I did bring all my work, and I Oh, we would cheat. We would sit around. All of us would try to read a magazine behind the book and try to let this off. But they would catch us. Marianne Fife and Helen Manier would catch us every time. I know you're reading a magazine. I know you have 10 more pages of homework you're supposed to be doing. And they would catch us and make us do our work, and they were very helpful. But it was difficult because you're going back and forth.
Yeah,
if you're
yeah.
at school for 2 weeks and you're on the set for 2 weeks, back and forth, you miss the lecture. You know, I always joke if you miss Algebra Chapter 9, the lecture, you're kind of, you can't, like, get through 10. It's a mess. But nowadays, with the Internet, thank God, kids can Zoom the classes. They're now doing more for child actors where they can record classes, they can Zoom classes, so they don't have to miss the instructional lectures. They've even done things where kids who are taking chemistry or biology and have to do lab, and they're
really?
Not at school. Why are they going to do lab on location? Bringing trailers with full chemistry labs down to a studio lot.
Wow.
So that they could do lab.
Really?
So they're trying to, like, make things work, because otherwise you're just ruining the education of someone just because they got a series and you can't. It's terrible. So we were in the rough old days where we did our homework, but I did manage to make it through high school and can fully read and write. So
that's good.
And some people do get through this and go to college, and so it's absolutely doable. There's lots of abuses. I've seen situations where parents said, well, I'll just pull them out of school and I'll homeschool. Now, some of them are homeschooling. Some of them are homeschooling with Internet classes and tutors. Some of them just said they were homeschooling and checked out, and that kid hasn't sat in the class or gone to school in years.
That's bad.
And they're just doing it so they can go to more auditions. Terrible. You know, have some stage parents are crazy.
Yeah.
So the schooling is difficult. You do have to apply yourself. If you don't like school, going to show business could be a problem, because if you're not doing that homework in those 3 hours, you are toast.
Oh, my God.
You're on your own, pal. So that's hard. And it really is about the crazy stage parents. If you have good stage parents who are saying, now, even though you're on a show, yes, you still have to graduate high school. You have to do your homework. You have to, like, go to school.
Good for them.
Yes, you're on a show, but you still have to remain physically fit. Besides, you're checking in with the doctor every 6 months. And you have to keep your grades up. And you have to have friends. You have to have a social life. And you have to be a normal person. You can do very well.
How did you make friends when they knew you were Nellie Olson?
Right. I kept my old friends. See, I had a bunch of friends. I had gone to school with since the third grade, because I went to Gardner Elementary, Bancroft Junior High. A lot of the kids from Gardner went to Bancroft and then went to Hollywood. So even by high school, there was still a core group. I'd known since third grade. They were still there. There were only two high schools that everybody went to in that neighborhood. So I still had them, and they didn't care. They'd known me since I was nine. What did they care? I was Nellie Olson.
Yeah.
And they grew up in Hollywood. Half of them had family in the business. Somebody's mom was a newscaster. Everybody knew someone who worked. Mm-hmm. So they didn't think it was a big deal, and they already knew me. And they went, oh, that's hilarious. Wait, you're playing what? You're playing Nellie Olson? That's hysterical. And they just thought it was really funny that I was playing the villain, and they did not care. So I'd be away. I'd come back to school, and they'd go, oh, good, you're back. And they'd catch me up on all the gossip of who was dating who and who broke up. And it was fine. So I kept those people. Smartest thing I ever did in my life, because so many child actors leave their school, they switch schools, they go to private school, they get a tutor, and they never see their friends again.
Not good.
They cut off the social life. They become isolated. Some stage parents are terrible with this. They say, oh, well, you're in showbiz, and you don't need to talk to those people anymore. They're
not
famous.
No kidding.
Worst thing you can do to a person. It's a horrible thing to do to a human being. You have to have friends who really know you, not as your character, who you can commiserate with. Because also with Nellie, making new friends, you bet it was difficult, because the new friends had seen the show. They didn't want to talk to me.
I hear you.
Oh, I had to tell people, okay, when you introduce me, don't mention the Nellie thing right away. Let's give it a few minutes, okay? Because they go, oh, this is Allison. She's great. She'll always play Nellie Olson. Boom, dead. Wait, this is Allison. She's an actress. I said, that's fine. And then, like, a couple hours in, we can get to the Nellie thing, and then it'll be fine because they've met me. But, yeah, it created a problem.
Gosh. Yeah, now, what about you, your own personal family life? Tell me about that.
Well, I do very well because I married a marvelous guy named Bob Schoonover, and he didn't get, in fact, he hadn't really watched the show much. I tended to date or marry people who didn't watch the show. So hadn't really watched it. He'd heard of it. He went, oh, yeah, Nellie. But he didn't care. He'd met a lot of celebrities. He really didn't care. He lived in L.A. He was actually very, very excited that my mother was Underdog's girlfriend, Sweet Polly.
Oh.
He got my mother's autograph when we first met. And we were, it was very like the movie When Harry Met Sally. We were friends for years before we went on a date. And now we just celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations. That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
And his family are fabulous. My family, everybody's passed away. My mother's gone. My father's gone. My Auntie Marion's gone. I have some cousins in Canada. Bob has this huge family. And his dad just died at almost 101. He almost made it 101. And he had the best 100th birthday. We went to his 100th birthday party. It was amazing. It was epic. But his sister-in-law is a stitch and a half. So I had a show. I was just in Louisville and then in Nashville. So several of his family drove out from Knoxville, Tennessee to Nashville, caught my show, and we went back to their house. And so I spent the weekend hanging out with my in-laws, and I went to my great-niece's dance recital and all sorts of normal family stuff, and we, like, got pizza and hung out.
I love that. That's some fantastic. Now, tell me, do you have
normal stuff. It's nice. Yeah.
Well, that's good. It keeps you grounded.
Right.
The whole. Tell me, do you have a philosophy of life?
So many. I mean, there's things my father used to say. We used to laugh at the time, but he was right. terrible thing my father used to say all the time is, you could be hit by a bus tomorrow.
Yeah.
Ooh. And sounds terrible, but it's true, because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
Enjoy today, right?
If you're not doing what you really want to be doing, if you're not having some fun in life, if you're not getting what you want or trying to go after what you want, you know, seriously, you could be hit by a bus tomorrow. What is it you're waiting for?
Yeah. So tell me about your one-woman show. What are you doing?
Well, I do this. As I said, I just was in at the Laurie Beachman Theater in New York and the Venus Cabaret in Chicago and Club Play, all over the country. So I talk about, well, being a crazy ex-child star, growing up in Hollywood. I talk about meeting Liberace. I have a lovely picture of me and Liberace when I was 8 years old.
Uh-huh.
I tell stories and about things being on the set and what it's like. I make joke about the fact that everyone hates me except the French. I have video clips of all these stories and pictures. It's hilarious. I talk about the horrible episode of Fantasy Island I was on where I played a prostitute, and it was completely a nightmare. But it's hilarious now because it was so bad. And I tell all these stories, and then we have a marvelous question and answer segment where I pass out cards before the show. I have cards passed out that say, ask Allison anything, seriously. And they do. And then I get them back to me right before the show. I don't get a chance to really look at them. In fact, the other night I had them, they handed to me on stage. And I get these cards and flip through them. And as I said, some of the questions are very nice. Some of them are completely ridiculous. And I sit there and I say, now wait, and I answer their questions.
Aww.
Well, who doesn't love that? They love that. They get their question. And because it's written down, they can be sort of anonymous. I'm not calling on them because they're shy and they won't raise their hand.
Yeah.
But if you give them the cards, they go crazy and they ask you all sorts of crazy stuff.
Okay, so here's a question. What's the worst question that was asked of you?
I'm not sure it's repeatable on the radio.
Uh-oh.
We do get a lot of questions where people want to know if anybody on the show, or specifically if I hooked up with, if I had sex with anyone from the show.
Seriously, really?
They wanted to, because we had handsome guest stars, Like, no. And the worst one is, you know, I it's become a joke because I say, well, did you have sex with Michael Landon?
Oh.
I said, well, first of all, I was 12, you perverts.
Yeah.
No. And I said, no, of course not. And that was the things that, I have a routine about it because this is absolutely true. I've actually never slept with anyone famous.
you know what?
I know.
That's
good. Everybody grows up in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's better.
When I had an affair with so-and-so. And they always have some story about some famous guy they dated or hooked up with or married. I'm like, nope, no famous, nobody. All these not famous people. And I said, well, you know, Melissa Gilbert, she at least dated Rob Lowe.
Yeah.
But I said, it's because I only got hit on by bad celebrities is my problem. Melissa gets Rob Lowe. I get Hervé Villechaize.
Oh, you know what? It's crazy. That's why you've been married 30 years. Because you got somebody who...
I get all the only the worst celebrities ever asked me. So I was like, oh, God, this is terrible. I'm clearly never dating anyone famous.
That's okay.
I picked people who weren't famous. And so I've had long relationships. And Bob, who was... Yes, he plays guitar, and he's in a band, but he was the least Hollywood person on the planet. He's from Akron, Ohio, and we've been married 30 years.
Yeah, but you don't compete with each other. Sometimes two actors will marry, and it's disastrous.
Well, we help each other. Like, when he was playing with his band, you know, he'll come with me. He doesn't come to all my events. He says, well, I'm coming. He's coming to Monte Carlo, and he might come to Walnut Grove. He picks them. He says, oh, that sounds fun. I'll take vacation. I'll come to that.
Yeah.
But when he's come to things, like the Simi Valley event where we had 18,000 people, he's like, oh, yeah, coming to that. And he would help. He sat, hung out at the table, and I had to keep leaving the autograph table to go do panels. So he entertained the fans.
Aww.
While I was away. And he kept saying, I'm not a stand-up comedian. I've been entertaining these people for 2 hours. You've got to get back to this table. And he made sure there was no time for lunch. So he's like, I went and got you a plate. Wait, I got you the chicken. So he's like bringing me food. So he would help. And he would make sure he'd say, okay, I can take these sales for the books. And when you come back, sign them. So and he writes the Nelly newsletter. If you sign up for the Nelly newsletter, once a month, you get an email newsletter, which has my schedule, everybody's schedule, and it's really funny, and it's hilarious. He writes this. He writes this whole thing, creates this whole Nelly newsletter. So he'll assist with things, but when his band's playing, I've worked the door at nightclubs with his band. I've sat in the back and sold CDs and T-shirts. I've introduced the band. I've promoted the band. So I help him.
Yeah.
I've carried his gear. I've carried his guitars up the stairs at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
But you keep each other's, you watch each other's back. That's great.
Exactly. We totally, that's the thing. When he's performing, I'm 100% in his camp. I'm backing him up. I'm performing. He's backing me up.
Perfect. How do they get the Nelly newsletter?
Oh, if you want the Nelly's newsletter, all you have to do, the website, I think you can sign up now. It's bonnethead.com. But if you send an email to Loose Gravel Prod, Loose Gravel Productions, of course, like I said, we've incorporated. We're very official over here. Loose Gravel, L-O-O-S-E, Loose Gravel, P-R-O-D, Prod, at AOL, Loose Gravel Prod at AOL, and say, I want the Nelly newsletter. You will start receiving the Nelly newsletter.
Oh, I love it. Now, what about Confessions of a Prairie Bitch? Where's that available?
Oh, that's everywhere. Just go on Amazon. You can get it in paperback. You can get it in Kindle, of course, very popular now.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get the audiobook if you wish. And you can get the audiobook either downloadable or, if you want, you can even purchase. Some people actually still will purchase a CD of the audiobook and play it that way. And I have those available. We'll autograph them. But I'll autograph anything. Absolutely. I got bonnets. I have T-shirts. I can sell you a T-shirt, really.
Yeah, why not?
When I go to the autograph shows now, I have my pictures. I have my book. I have aprons, T-shirts, bonnets, and I even have a few DVDs and Blu-rays of the movies I've done, both Throw Out the Anchor from when I was a child and Even in Dreams, a marvelous film I made a couple years ago. Oh, and I have a movie coming out. I'll probably have DVDs of that soon. I made a movie just last year called Buster Brooks.
Buster Brooks.
And that's coming out any minute. It's hilarious. It's the story of a not terribly bright farm boy. It's can a not very smart farm boy make it overnight in Hollywood in time to save the family farm with the help of his pet chicken named Edgar?
Oh, my gosh. What part do you play?
They said, can we name you Nelly in this? I said, what? They said, well, you run the coffee shop where all the people on Hollywood Boulevard hang out, and you throw him out of your coffee shop because he's playing the banjo and he has a chicken with him, and you're not standing for that. And I said, fabulous. So I'm very mean to him. And they said, can we call it Nelly's Coffee Shop? I'm sorry. It's just too darn funny. We're doing that. I said, fine, do it.
Uh-huh.
So it's absolutely adorable. And I'm very pleased with it. It's the same producer did Even in Dreams, where I play an evil band manager, and I'm so evil. Buster Brooks is played by Matt Cornett, by the way. Do you know who Matt Cornett is?
No.
He's absolutely darling. He's from High School Musical, the series.
Oh, okay.
He's one of the stars of High School Musical, and very popular in that, and he works like mad. He's, of course, adorable, very cute, and he's an extremely intelligent, charming young man, and he plays the dumbest guy you ever met in your life.
That's a smart person.
Oh, yeah, brilliant. He's so talented, because I met him, he's like, oh, my God, this guy's so smart, he's so cool, he's lovely, and then as soon as the camera, he's Buster Brooks, you could see right through to the back of his head, dumb as a post. And so he's marvelous, so he's the lead. But I do get to throw him out of my cafe and scream at him.
That is so cute. So do you know when Buster Brooks is going to be coming out?
I'm saying any minute at this point. I just finished a couple months ago. I think they're just finishing up like the music and the editing.
Can you have Harlan let me know?
He's EJ on High School Musical. It's fantastic.
Okay. Let me know, or have Harlan let me know when the movie comes out.
Oh,
I can have you back so we can plug it.
Yeah, I'm going to hit everywhere when that comes out. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, good. Because I want to plug it for you.
Oh, cool, cool, excellent.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us. You are the best.
Thank you.
I love talking with you.
Anytime. I'm happy to come back.
Terrific. Stay well, stay happy, and I know it's going to be a great life for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You bet. Allison Ingram. She's Nellie. She's always going to be Nellie. But Allison Ingram is also a very talented and a lovely, lovely lady. All right, folks, thank you so much for being with us. In the meantime, here's my